This is a podcast that seeks justice. Justice for the lives stolen by those in society that hide amongst us every day. Hidden in our towns, cities, and countrysides, the places that we work, and sometimes in our very own homes. This is Hidden Killers.
Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining us. My name is Tony Bruschi. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts to not miss any of the breaking updates and discussions that we have on the cases that we are following for you. Today, we're going to be talking about Brian Koberger and what is going on in Moscow, Idaho, a town that has seen such trauma over the last several months. Not only the trauma of the murders themselves, but then of the press descending upon the city, asking everyone questions, criticizing this, criticizing that. It's a lot for one town to handle. Dr. John Delatorre, a licensed psychologist, is joining us to discuss what exactly it takes for a community that has gone through something like this to heal. Right now, the media attention not as strong as it had been in the past because we're basically waiting for more developments in the case to take place and the legal proceedings to move forward. But they're going to be in a yo-yo effect for the next several years, likely. How does a town cope?
I think some of it has to be that you have to block out what some of this attention actually is. I think the community as a whole needs to understand, yes, there are going to be cameras there at times, and no, there aren't going to be cameras there at other times. But the community exists whether there are cameras there or not, right? The school semester has already started, right? There are already going to be things that, you know, that regularly occur in that community that they need to focus on. I think in some ways, you need to go about business as usual. I think if you're able to sort of normalize everything that's going on, if you're able to recognize it for what it is, which is just, again, fleeting kinds of interest in what's going on in your community, if you recognize it as just being a product of what society does, I think that's the first step. Then the second step includes regular community gatherings, regular interactions with one another, more positive interactions with one another, supporting each other as businesses, as residents, doing those kinds of things, because communities always heal each other, heal from within.
Can you shed some light into the possible mindset of Koberger? If we're assuming that he is the killer, and it's until proven guilty, how does one make the transition from being socially awkward to stalking, targeting people that he didn't closely know, as far as we're all aware of, and eventually killing them? How do you keep moving the goalposts of acceptability of life's behaviors to that level?
Well, you know, it's again, one of those things, if you ask 10 different psychologists, you're going to get 10 different answers. You know, with some answers, try to put Koberger in a group of individuals like incels. And so I think that's more of a shorthand for everybody else to feel more comfortable, that as if they understood him. The truth is that only he knows why he did what he did. But usually what we're thinking of is that someone has decided that the slights that they are experiencing, wherever they come from and whether or not they even exist, are so damaging, right? They're more than just a slight from within. It's actual sort of real crumbling of the person's self-esteem that they feel as though they've lost control. And no one wants to feel out of control. And so they begin fantasizing about what control would be. How do I get control back? Those fantasies only go so far until you actually have to start engaging in physical behaviors. Once you start doing that, you start fantasizing again about, okay, now I've done this, this is how I'm going to move forward. It's a long, long process of moving from one stage to the next, but it always includes sort of internal fantasizing about what it would mean to either exact revenge or gain control, use your power, use your entitlement, use your authority, while also denigrating the object of those kinds of those targets. You denigrate them, you objectify them, you make them less than human. It's at that point then, once you feel comfortable with where you are in your anger and in your sort of desire for power and control back, and where you see them as a human being capable of suffering. When you feel comfortable with those two positions, that's when you're going to act.
What would the end goal be for someone to do something like this?
A return of power. Right? It's really just as simple as that, that engaging in a behavior like this, once it's done, there's an emotional sort of, I'm going to say catharsis, but what I mean is an actual emotional release. There, during that fantasy process, there's anxiety, there's depression, there's sadness, there's nervousness, there's all different kinds of emotions that the person is feeling, but doesn't want to feel anymore. And once the behavior is done, there's a release of all of it, to include gratification and satisfaction, right? To include shame and guilt, right? Jealousy and envy, all of those things sort of disperse. And all that's left with is the person's control back, right? The perceived control back. That's what's left. That's why we see individuals who engage in acts of mass violence, right? That they can have these sort of blank faces, these blank stares. This is why they have them, because there's an emotional release of all of that. The only thing that's left is the perceived control that they have, again, allegedly gotten back. Is it real? Potentially it's real, right? But it really is just their own perception of getting that power and control back.
Well, it's interesting because I understand where they may feel that for a moment, and they may have power and control in the moment of taking someone's life. But are they assuming that they won't get caught? I mean, does the planning and the mindset of how you're emotionally going to deal with this, is that just never conceived of until the crime actually takes place and they don't realize the repercussions and then the extreme lack of control that you will have if you do get caught?
I think they've considered it prior to actually engaging. I'm pretty sure it's part of the fantasy process in terms of how would they get away with this. But there are some individuals. So again, if someone believes that this guy was an incel, they don't care about whether or not they get caught. In fact, it would be preferable that they actually get caught, because then they can spread their message even wider, which is why I don't think that he's an incel. I think he shares some thought processes that incels share. But the truth is that some of the thought processes of entitlement and sexual entitlement and rejection being seen as severe wounds to the self-esteem, those are all byproducts of a patriarchal society of oppression, not necessarily an incel. Incels perform, they engage in performance crimes. They want to be caught because they want their message out there and they believe in what they did. They don't think it's wrong. They don't really try to cover anything up. So for these kind of individuals, and certainly someone like Koberger, It does appear like they tried to do things to cover it up. They really did consider. Again, humans make mistakes, but yeah. It does really seem that he tried to take steps to cover up what he was doing.
One of the things that we don't know about yet is a murder weapon, and that may be one of those things that is covered up. As far as we know, someone like him, they sometimes take trophies, and it's not always necessarily the murder weapon itself. In your experience, would you assume that maybe he has that weapon somewhere or has it stored somewhere as a trophy, or would this be something that he would want to have disposed of so nobody could ever hit their hands on it again, even himself if he wanted to?
Yeah, I don't see anything ritualistic about what he's done. I don't think that he's engaged in homicide before. So there's nothing to say that the knife would have been that important that he needed to keep it. I do think that he probably disposed of it. Whoever did this, whether it's Koberger or not, I think the individual probably did dispose of it. And sometimes the only trophy that you need is the memory of engaging in it.
He's obviously in jail now. We've heard many stories of his OCD tendencies. Speak to that a little bit, the challenges psychologically for someone like Koberger that he could be facing in prison, not able to live his regular, very specific daily routine. Is that something that would break someone down mentally further, or does someone like him find ways of kind of being a chameleon and ways to survive that sort of a setting?
Well, obsessive compulsive disorder used to be designated under an anxiety disorder, and that's for a reason. the obsessive and the compulsive nature of the disorder are used to mask high levels of anxiety. So it's certainly possible that in situations where individuals are not able to engage in the compulsive acts associated with the obsessions, the anxiety level absolutely skyrockets. Will he try to manage it in jail and prison potentially? Sure, he'll try, but prisons aren't designed for helping individuals with mental illness. Mm-hmm. So it'll only last for so long before something is going to happen. And what could that be? It could be any number of things.
Dr. John Della Torre, licensed psychologist, thank you again for joining us and providing your insights on that case. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our breaking updates and discussions on the cases that we're following. You can get a commercial-free version of the podcast, including access to all of our shows ad-free when you sign up through Apple Podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod. Until next time, for all of us here, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.